Hello, hello, you're listening to Blueprint for Living, and I'm Michael Williams, and if travel broadens the mind, then today we're cracking your noggin wide open with today's show. We're journeying near and far in methods old and new. We're going to kick it off with a look at, if not the future of travel, then the very science fiction edges of travel's present day. That's in just a minute, but before we get there, I want to reassure you traditionalists out there, it's not all gimmicks and gizmos and high-tech alternatives. Coming up, we're also going to be embracing some older technology for the curious holiday maker. Designed to application, we're going caravanning. Plus, still on the road, for Sense of Place, author and memoirist Beth Yap takes us to Kuala Lumpur, the Malaysia of her childhood. It's an escapist blueprint for living this week, so do stay with us. That aquatic noise, as unlikely as it sounds, might be the sound of the future. I don't know about you, but I feel utterly robbed by the future. Where's my flying car? Where's my silver jumpsuit? Where's my virtual reality? It's here. It's here, I promise. It's arrived. That's right, programmers began exploring VR, as it's known, back in 1985. But the tech just wasn't up to it. There was this vision about what immersive 3D entertainment might look like and the endless educational and other potential for it. But now it's arriving. It's arriving in the form of smartphones and cardboard kits that you can put up to your face that make it all possible. And Tourism Australia are hoping that it's a real thing. They've just spent about $40 million on a campaign using virtual reality immersion tech to market Australia to the world. That little snippet we heard was your opportunity to dive deep into the sea with seals all around you. They launched it in New York in January of this year. And with me to explain the strategy is their marketing manager, Matt McInnes. Matt, is it working?
Absolutely. I think early on, we only launched 2 months ago, but we've seen a tremendous amount of increased traffic and more engagement with the platforms that we've shared our virtual reality technology on, both with headsets and online. And it's led to more leads to industry as well. So we're up about 77% from our web sources. So we think that's an encouraging start.
So, Matt, is it just a gimmick? I mean, is this just another way to repackage the same beautiful images and kind of standard promotional stuff, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's two things. There's no doubt that consumers have changed quite a lot, and to get their attention nowadays is never easy, so you always need to look for new ways. And our mission is to make sure that we make Australia the most desirable and memorable destination on earth, and virtual reality really lends itself to appealing to consumers globally, and in particular to our eastern markets, which are a core for us for growth into the future.
So how so? I mean, how does virtual reality do that more effectively than good old-fashioned reality?
I think that the virtual reality really puts you into the moment. Our research suggests that those that have been to the country are 25% more likely to rate us for high-quality aquatic and coastal experiences compared to those that haven't. And if we're to turn those people that haven't been to the country around, it's techniques and new media like virtual reality that allows us to take the country to the world and for them to get closer to experience what it's actually like, and then obviously lead through to booking a trip from there. So
you say immersed in the environment. I have now experienced this, but for our listeners who haven't, tell them, how do people see it? How do they experience it? What happens?
Well, there's a number of ways that the technology can be used through, as you said before, you know, from Google Cardboard through to headsets, which are now becoming more widespread across the globe, like Samsung headsets, etc. That's probably the optimal way to view, where you completely put the headset on, and if you want to swim with the sea lions in Port Lincoln, you know, you'll put that on and you'll experience and swim with them, and it's as real as actually being there. You know, I was actually there myself for that shoot, and when I wear the headset compared to being in that environment, that they're very, very close. It's something that other media types is not able to convey to consumers that we're trying to encourage to come to Australia.
It's a pretty massive investment on your part, though. I mean, this is the biggest VR advertising campaign in Australia to date. How involved is the shooting of it? What goes into it? How many cameras?
There's quite a lot involved in the pre-production side of things. Everything from different rigs being set up and drones that fly. And in a typical virtual reality filming sequence, I think we had 8 to 10 GoPro cameras that are set up to capture all different angles. And depending upon the location, you know, that may require a drone to fly at a certain distance, or it may be something that's static in the ground where the activity happens around it. So it's very complex in stitching all of those cameras together to make it look as seamless as possible.
Matt, I'm looking forward to seeing some of the other 17 VR experiences that are rolling out there. It's a lot of fun. You can access that app via the Blueprint for Living website, and it is a free app of all things. Matt McInnes is the Marketing Manager at Tourism Australia, and you can follow the links on the Blueprint for Living program page to immerse yourself in what he's been up to. But the big question is, what's going on in our brains when we're immersed in this 3D virtual world? Professor Jim Blazkowicz has studied the psychological aspects of virtual reality for many years. Jim's from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he joins me now. Hi, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you've said the greatest VR instrument is our brain. What do you mean by that?
Well, the way our brain and senses work really tends to create an assumption that we could be someplace else. I mean, for example, we dream every night, 4, 5, 6 times a night, and many of those times we're completely immersed in that dream and actually can wake up believing we were just somewhere else, either in a scary way or perhaps a happy way. And people have been taking to virtual reality for a long time simply endogenously, simply with their own minds. They dream, and people daydream. People's minds wander 2,000 times a day during waking hours, and about half of those are tuning out and half of those are zoning out. So for some reason, we seem to be constructed as mind travelers, and when we can get the senses into it in the actual physical world, it becomes even stronger. So the history of virtual reality technology started with storytelling thousands of years ago, and maybe then on to cave art, and then on to theater, and then on to sculpture, eventually onto manuscripts. The printing press was a paradigm shift because it allowed people to share virtual realities via the printed page in books. And coming more up to modern times through photography, cinematography, radio, television, and now what we call digital virtual environments. So it's nothing new for humans. Our minds wander all the time. We imagine ourselves in other places. And the whole history of actual media, in retrospect, looks like ways of improving our experiences that are virtual.
The ones that really jumped out at me, that I used a couple. I was reading that the New York Times now has an entire division devoted to using this platform for their journalism. And I did one that took me to a Syrian refugee camp. And it was incredibly moving. Like, it was a story that would have been moving in any medium, but something about doing it through this immersive technology meant that it was even more emotionally charged, it was even more immediately empathetic. Is that me being kind of lulled into it by the technology?
No, I don't think necessarily, but I think the technology is necessary. You know, look, our brains work on two levels, an explicit level where we're conscious of what we're doing and conscious of what we think and conscious of where we're going, and an implicit level, which does all those things without our own awareness. And so when we start engaging in technologies that reproduce, for example, three-dimensional places and spaces and three-dimensional sound and all those things, there's a lot of implicit things that are at work at the more unconscious level that draw us even further. The prime example in anybody's virtual reality lab of getting people convinced that it works is to put them virtually on a precipice. No one will jump off that precipice, even though they know there's no hole there. So, I mean, it's very, why don't they do that? Well, it's because implicitly their brain's telling them not to. Because in our whole history of evolution, a hole is a hole, and you don't want to fall down it.
Are you saying our brain doesn't easily differentiate between the virtual and the real?
That's exactly right. Even if it's in a book. For example, my daughter and I were watching a Harry Potter movie in a movie theater, and she said, "Dad, look, it's really real. It's just like in the book."
I'm just curious about whether you think there's a potential downside to these kind of experiences. Does the data suggest that it would make people more inclined to kind of withdraw from the real world?
Well, I'm sure that can be the case. And we didn't need 3D virtual reality for that to happen,
no,
as the gaming industry has shown us. You know, I think that one of the things I've thought of in thinking about this interview in Tourism Australia is there's a point, and I'm sure they've thought about it, there's a point at which why come if you can do the whole thing virtually?
Of course, no need for long-haul travel.
Yes. So that's the yin and the yang of it, and it's a very interesting issue. But I'm sure they've also thought about, let's not give the whole store away. Let's just give people a really interesting experience, because sights and sounds and places in Australia are much more impactful if you're able to see them in 3D, walk around in them, etc. That's very compelling. But as soon as all of Australia gets made a virtual world, and people can go there any time, what happens? Do they actually fly over, or do they just see it from their living room? So the point we try to make is virtual reality has been around for a long time, and when it becomes so virtual that we don't even think about the technology, then it becomes very, very compelling, and I think very, very useful. So just as an example, right now you and I are not talking to each other. We're talking to an audio avatar of our voices. Do we think about that and let it interrupt our interaction? Absolutely not. Well, now the same thing's happening on the video level.
So I have been completely suckered in. I'm not going to deny it by preparing for this story. I've been using one of the little cardboard ones that a colleague gave me, and I'm kind of addicted. But what I want to know is, are we at a tipping point? Is this the right time to be buying? What's the future for VR? Should I run out and buy shares?
Yes.
Okay, say it.
Absolutely. And we were doing virtual reality 25 years ago, okay? And we were doing it with head-mounted displays and sound and everything. But what we predicted about the year 2002 is the virtual reality technology explosion would occur not when head-mounted displays got cheaper, but when tracking systems for the home got cheaper. So what was that? Well, it was the Microsoft Kinect for $100 US. That's a great tracking system. With that tracking system, people can buy what previous to that had been the most expensive component in a virtual reality system. It's really the technology getting better, getting cheaper, and allowing us to have deeper, richer virtual experience, including visual ones. And not just a movie, and not just a book, and not just a radio, et cetera. So the technology has now taken and has made a paradigm shift, much as it did with the printing press. So this is kind of here to stay. Now, that said, as I think I alluded to a little bit earlier, any technology can be used for good things or can be used for bad things, and that's going to be no different with VR.
So how do you think the application of it, now that the take-up is going to get easier as smartphone technology and everything means that the kind of mechanisms for using it are going to get more ubiquitous, where are we going to be using it? Where's the take-up going to be most kind of prevalent in the next 20 years, do you think?
Well, I think certainly in education. There's reasons to go to Australia other than tourism, to go to other cultures, to place yourself in battlefields even. So I think it's just drawing the possible connections between all the individuals who inhabit this planet closer. You know, we used to play this game, I don't know if it made it to Australia, but in the States not that many years ago, just a few years ago, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. Did you ever hear that?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, and at one time, 6 Degrees of Freedom was what it took if you mailed a letter to somebody you didn't know on the other side of the world via somebody you did know and who they knew and all that stuff, etc. Okay? It was laborious. Now it happens instantaneously. Half the world is wired. And probably more, that's going to increase and increase and increase. So when you can connect with anybody else in the world or almost anybody else in the world with one phone call or virtual reality call or whatever it's going to be called, that is paradigm shifting.
I want to ask you when you bought your shares in Skynet, but I'm confident that that's not the case.
Maybe after this call.
I've been speaking with the audio avatar of Professor Jim Blaskovich from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Jim's book is Infinite Reality, and the details are online on the Blueprint for Living program page, as are the links to some of the ways in which you can get into a virtual reality. Who needs to travel nowadays? You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams.
Tomorrow, movies for your ears.
They're made out of meat. They're completely meat.
That's impossible. What about the radio signals?
They use radio waves to talk, but the signals don't come from them. The signals come from machines.
The truth take over Radiotonic.
You're asking me to believe it's sentient meat.
I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. These creatures are the only sentient race in the sector, and they're made out of meat.
Just look for The Truth on the RN website.
Always on the move, always on the move. We'll never see it all, so we've got no time to lose. Gonna hook the camper up and get the show on the road.
Long before we could strap a helmet to our faces to escape our day-to-day lives, we could hook a metal box to the back of the family Holden and escape them on the open road. Always on the move indeed, our home away from home in mobile form. But the caravan's come a long way since Toad of Toad Hall was seduced by the caravanning life. Some of these portable homes give my actual fixed dwelling a run for its money. So, is the future of caravanning a design revolution, or is this a mode of holiday that's more about simplicity and tradition than about the latest innovations? I'm joined by Ron Chapman. Ron's CEO of Caravanning Queensland in Brisbane, and here in the studio with me is Lucy Hersey, who's a caravanning enthusiast and contributor to Australian Caravan and RV magazine. Good morning to you both. I'm going to start with you, Ron. Help clear something up for me. What's the difference between a caravan and a motorhome?
Well, a caravan is a towed product, of course, and a motorhome, sometimes called a camper van, is built onto a vehicle chassis, and as such, it's not towing anything, although a lot of people do then tow a smaller vehicle behind it. So when they get to the site they're going to, they haven't got to pack up their home. They've still got a vehicle to run down the shops to get a bottle of milk.
Two different existences, one where you're driving the thing you live in and one where you drag it behind you. So over the evolution, what have been the big milestones in the exterior design of the caravan? Let's focus on the towed version.
Well, caravans started, or the first recorded ones were in the 20s. As a matter of fact, our association here in Queensland owns Australia's first caravan. Well, so we believe it is, and no one's disputed it. And it was basically a 6x4 wooden box trailer. And a boat builder in Tasmania built a few wooden bows on the top of it, pulled some canvas around tight on that, painted it to make it waterproof, put a couple of seats stroke beds inside, and that was the caravan. It was used by some people by the name of Bailey from Deloraine in Tasmania to tow with their T-model Ford so they could go fishing. They were sheep farmers, and they went fishing up on the north coast of Tasmania, and they had their accommodation and their cooker inside. Mind you, the cooker was cooked outside, an old cast iron one, but they just loaded everything in, and it's so easy then to accommodate themselves. Now, from there, we progressed through the 30s with a few timber manufactured caravans, same thing in the 40s. Then we got into the 50s before the industry really started to develop. But they were still timber caravans, and the transition into aluminium-clad caravans came in that period, late 50s into the 1960s.
So once they moved to aluminium, presumably their resilience, the kinds of things they started to have ambitions for in terms of what they held, would have come along in leaps and bounds.
Absolutely, yes. A vast difference to the interiors in the caravans in those days. All of a sudden, instead of having methylated spirit stoves inside, they had LP gas. LP gas or dual operation refrigerators, 240 volt and 12, and LP gas came into existence. They were put into the caravans in the 60s particularly, and we progressed to today where there can be three-way fridges, gas, electric and 12 volt. You know, we really started putting things in that people had at home because they wanted all the comforts when they were away of what they had at home, within reason. You get to today in that regards, well, they do have all the comforts at home Dishwashers, washing machines, clothes dryers, ice makers, all those things are available in caravan side.
Right, I'm not convinced. This is not caravanning. This is like this glamping idea where it's all just churched up inside. Who are the demographic for caravans? I mean, what does your members, who are most people who are doing it?
Everybody. There is no real demographic. The largest users of caravans in Australia, despite people thinking it's what's known as the grey nomads, is actually the families from the 30 through to 54 year age group. The 55 to 70s are the next biggest users, and then there's a mixture after that.
But okay, we're joined here in the studio in Melbourne by Lucy Hersey. Lucy, you're 25. You resolutely don't fit either of those demographics that Ron's talking about. What drew you to caravanning?
I guess I have really fond memories of caravanning with my family when I was a kid, and the kind of make-your-own-adventure style holiday where we would go and tow the van and Dad would be driving and Mum would look up information about the places we were going and she'd read it to us while we were getting there, and it was like having a tour guide. And, yeah, I guess that kind of nostalgia, it really resonates with me. And I really love the idea of having a small, tidy little house space that you can take with you wherever you go. And the way, you know, holidaying in a sort of basic caravan setup or a vintage caravan forces you to really slow down and appreciate what you're doing. You know, it takes a long time to make a cup of coffee on a gas stove, so you really appreciate the cup of coffee when you make it, I think.
So you're particularly a fan of vintage caravans. So what is it about the vintage ones? Is it because for you they're a memory of childhood holidays, so you're going for the nostalgia thing, or is there something else to it?
I think it's a bit of nostalgia, but it's the aesthetic as well. I think vintage caravans are sort of beautiful organic shapes. They're thoughtfully designed, and I kind of like the idea that a lot of them are handmade and 100% Australian made, so it's kind of like owning a little bit of history as well.
Talk me through the bits you fetishise. What are the bits of design that you just can't get enough of?
Anything with curved walls is pretty good.
Yeah. I can totally see that. Is caravanning, though, for you, is this just camping for people who are a bit wary about the great outdoors?
I don't think so, because you still have to get pretty in touch with nature, even though you're in a caravan, but it certainly does make it a little bit more comfortable than camping in a tent, I guess.
And you find when you head out, your fellow caravanners, there are many people of your generation there, or is it still, are you seeing the combination of families and the grey nomad thing that Ron pointed to as the two big demographics?
Yeah, it's definitely a mix, and I think it depends where you head to. If you sort of head for well set up caravan parks with playgrounds and so on, you'll encounter a lot of families. But if you go a little bit more off-road and you head for free campsites out in the national park or something, then you encounter all sorts of people.
Your enthusiasm doesn't just extend to using these for your holidays. You've gone the full bottle. You even restore old caravans yourself. What goes into that?
A lot of sealing, a lot of sanding. I think the key to a good restoration is picking something with good bones to start with. It's no good getting something that's completely rotten.
Sealing doesn't sound promising. Are you telling me that the old ones, it's all just leakage and the natural elements seeping into the corners?
It really depends how they've been stored and when the caravan was built. So, like we heard before, in the 50s, the caravans were built of timber, and obviously wear and tear over the years leads that to rot. But a lot of aluminium caravans, if they've been stored properly, you can get them without leaks, but it is rare.
Ron, Lucy must be music to your ears, not just loving caravanning, but loving restoring old ones. Some people custom design their vans as well. What are the more outlandish examples of this that you've seen over the years?
Well, back in the early 70s, I was working for a caravan manufacturer, and we built a very big caravan. It was for a bridge builder who built all of the bridges in Cape York to open up that road right through to the Cape. And I remember we built into that a bar for him that had a genuine cowhide front on it. Now, that was rather extravagant at the time, I can tell you. But you know, the other things that go in these days. Well, I'll use another example I remember seeing about probably 20 years ago. The Sultan of Brunei got a manufacturer in Melbourne to build some caravans for him for his polo field so that they could just go and relax there between chuckers. And it had gold-plated taps in it as well.
Oh, fantastic. If I was a sultan, I would want gold-plated taps in my caravan, that's for sure.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, they're probably a little bit over the top, gold-plated taps, but you can virtually have anything you like. As I said earlier, these days you can get appliances that are made to suit caravans, and people are more than happy. There's probably these days well over 50% of caravans are built fully built self-contained with their own toilet and shower, and I wouldn't know the exact percentage, but I'd say probably 15 to 20% now have a washing machine or a dishwasher installed. And then some people go the whole hog if their caravan is big enough put in everything else.
The shift to in-caravan toilets must have been a pretty revolutionary moment. When did that happen?
Oh, look, I've been in the industry 50 years this year, and we were installing toilets back in the mid-60s. But that was pretty rare. We weren't putting them in all that many domestic caravans. We were putting them mainly into commercial caravans that were being built for geologists and the like who were researching, drilling for minerals and so on. For the domestic caravan, toilets probably didn't really get introduced until about 1969, thereabouts. I remember a manufacturer I was working for then actually developed a fiberglass ensuite that went onto the back of the caravan. So, and it was about 3 foot wide, 3 foot deep. So if you had a 20-foot caravan, a standard layout, you could buy a 23-footer and add this module on the back.
This is like the babushka doll of caravans, just for the toilet option. It's your babushka dolling your way down the road. Ron, we've focused on the ways in which they've evolved from a kind of comfort and amenity perspective, but one of the big evolutions must be safety and the way in which that features in design. Particularly when caravanners are keen to use vintage and antique ones, are there things they need to look out for? Are there safety features that aren't a constant from those earlier generations?
Probably in the vintage era, they need to watch the LP gas installation. Some of them were pretty primitive back in those days, didn't have enough ventilation for the gas. These days, very strict rules on LP gas installation, very strict rules on 240 volt installation, and even on the towing side of things, there is an Australian development called electronic stability control, which has now been used and developed further overseas, being widely used in Europe now and to a degree in America, and that was developed here in Australia. So the industry here has always been very conscious of all these things in conjunction with Australian design rules for the federal government and Australian standards. All of these things have been developed for the safety of the customers, and very seldom do you hear of a death involving caravans, unless it is later proved it has been through misuse.
Just finally, Lucy, I know your favourite van is one that you've called Woody. Do you name them all? Is the naming of them part of it for you?
Yeah, it is. I think our vintage vans have a lot of personality, and it kind of seems fitting to give them a name that suits.
It seems only fun to have your mode of transport make the journey as much as the destination the point of the thing. Thank you so much to you both. Ron Chapman is CEO of Caravanning Queensland in Brisbane, and Lucy Hersey is a caravanning enthusiast and contributor to Australian Caravan and RV magazine. If you have your own personalised favourite mode of travel, do put it on the Facebook page or on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. Travel enthusiasts Beth Yarp is coming up to tell us about Malaysia, but before we get there, we're going to heirloom apples.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN. Keep up with the latest in design, food, travel and gardens. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or the ABC Radio app.
This weekend, the Adelaide Botanic Gardens is playing host to an heirloom festival. Frankly, any activity that incorporates a pumpkin-growing competition is okay with me. But in this age of large-scale commercial agriculture, let's face it, it's worth taking a moment to celebrate those traditional varieties of plants that are grown and harvested a little differently. So today we're going to look at the humble and not-so-humble apple. What's out there? What choice exists for the keen apple lover? And is heirloom the answer? Is that going to get me past the fact that if I go to a supermarket, all I seem to be getting is pink ladies and Granny Smith and nothing in between? The Heirloom Weekend is co-presented by the Diggers Club, who are Australia's largest garden club, and its founder, Clive Blasey, joins me now. Clive, help me out on a definitional question to begin with. Did I get that right? What does heirloom refer to when it comes to fruit and veg?
Heirloom relates to, I guess, varieties that have disappeared as a consequence of us now mostly going to supermarkets to buy all our food. So if we go back to the 1900s, there's probably 3,000 or 4,000 different apples around the world, maybe 200 or 300 in Australia. Now in the supermarket, you might get 4 or 5, maybe 10 all round. And so some of the best apples have disappeared because they don't have the shelf life.
Sorry, Clive, 3,000 or 4,000 different varietals of apples.
Yes. Well, you see, in the olden days, apples like beer were turned into cider, and that was the only way you got clean water, you might say. And of course, when America was colonized, referring back to Johnny Appleseed, he went to a cider factory, picked up all the seeds, and then spread them all away on the trails, and that's how we got an enormous range of varieties. So apples have been our most popular fruit probably for 300 or 400 years in Northern Europe. And so that's how we got so many varieties.
So why have we whittled that down to 5 or 6? What on earth possesses kind of agriculture to do such things?
Well, the same's happened in tomatoes. There's 3,000 or 4,000 different varieties of tomatoes, and frankly, what's offered in the supermarket is a modern hybrid, which is really the genetics of only one or two. So, that's really our specialty, to preserve these older varieties of fruits and vegetables, and that's what the Heirloom Festival at the Adelaide Botanic Gardens is really designed to do.
So, as you say, apples are, perennial, they're a great favourite fruit, and they're kind of winnowed down. So if heirloom is the answer, if that's going to get us past this kind of lack of species variety, where can we grow backyard apples in Australia?
Well, the great thing is now that we've got dwarfing rootstocks, you take the clone of, let's say, a snow apple or a Macintosh or a Jonathan, and it's grafted onto this dwarf rootstock. So you and I are only spaced about a metre apart. We could have 2 trees, but between us in 10 square metres, we could have 5 to 10 trees. Now,
I'm not sure the ABC had approved of that planting plan, Clive, but no, go on.
And these trees would be specially pruned so that the laterals would produce fruit along, let's say, 3 wires, and they'd be 3, a metre, 1.5 and 2 metres high. We'd get enough fruit off that to keep every family happy. So you need a tiny amount of space. You probably need 30 days sunshine. But that's a big advantage, because in the olden days, your apple tree might have covered 8 metres across or something, and you'd only get one in your backyard.
So condition-wise, they need the chill factor, don't they? So it needs to be south of the country, it needs to be inland generally?
Yes. They don't take to tropical or subtropical humid conditions, so north of Sydney up to Brisbane is no good, but you can grow them on the inland as long as you get the appropriate number of chilling hours. So the trick, of course, with apples, apart from the harvest period going for 4 or 5 months, and therefore you probably want 4 varieties to give you a harvest all the way through. The trick, of course, is that you have to have the pollinators, and they're not a self-pollinating crop like tomatoes are. So you do generally have to have more than one, but that's a detail. If you grew Jonathan, which is a terrific eating apple, it would pollinate everything that flowered at the same time.
I don't want to be rude, Clive, but you've come in here and the smell of apple has filled the studio, which is a wonderful smell. It's kind of a immediately fresh, immediately kind of memorable one. Are there particular varieties you would recommend for the home backyard?
Yes, I'm not sure whether you want to do some taste tests on the site, but
go on. Radio's always improved by the sound of me eating.
That's a snow apple, which I think is a fantastic variety, very white. That's disappeared off the market. It's pretty small.
Oh, that is nice.
That's a mid-season. That's a pity that one's disappeared, I think. I've got two. There was one other one I particularly... Jonathan's fairly conventional, but Cox's Orange Pippin is a variety which I guess is the most popular in England and in various parts of Australia does particularly well. So you might like to try that and say what you think about it.
Tell me, as I bite into the Cox's Orange Pippin, tell me, are there particularly Australian varieties
that do particularly well here? This is actually quite exciting because generally... in terms of cultivars of fruit and vegetables, we take what comes from Europe. But in fact, in Perth or Western Australia, we now have Pink Lady came from there. There's about four varieties. Of course, Granny Smith is an Australian worldwide selection. And while we're talking about Granny Smith, most of us think of it as a cooking apple and eat it green. But if you let it turn into a sort of mild yellow, it is, I think, the best eating apple there is. But don't eat it you'd leave it till June or July.
I'm just going to let our listeners know from a taste perspective, the Cox's Orange Pippin and the snow apple are quite different. They're different consistency, but the Cox's has a kind of almost a tartness to it, but it's a beautiful apple, kind of.
Tart apples generally don't get into supermarkets. What gets into supermarkets is high sugar. You know, Fuji, which I must say I like a lot. I think that's why Fuji's such a popular.
Does well in a lunchbox. So, okay, the gardening tips. We need to do this very quickly in a couple of minutes. But is it best to plant them bare rooted or potted?
Bare rooted. Is going to be slightly cheaper, but it means that you have to buy them in winter and plant them before the end of August. Potted ones are just those bare-rooted varieties and available all through the year. So it doesn't matter. You've just got to make sure your bare-rooted ones don't dry out. If the roots dry out, you know, you're taking a risk, which doesn't happen in a pot.
And you have other tips for the home growing to remember? I mean, there's the need for the pollinators, there's the fact that they need to be grafted onto good rootstock.
Yes. We recommend people use espaliering techniques because that means you can grow a lot more varieties and that means you get fresh apples because, of course, when you're buying something from the supermarket, they're stored under controlled conditions and they might be 6 or 10 months old. So fresh makes a huge difference.
Five Blazy, fresh makes a huge difference. These are delicious apples. I'm going to eat my way through the rest of the show. Clive Blazes from the Diggers Club, and details on Adelaide's Heirloom Festival are on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. You're listening to Blueprint for Living, which makes this some enchanted Saturday morning, or some enchanted whatever random time you listen to podcasts. I don't know, but it's enchanted one way or the other. And Beth Yarp is taking us to Malaysia.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded.
Beth Yarp is a traveller from a family of travellers, as she describes it. She's also an editor and an author. She's published a novel, a libretto, short stories. She's edited fiction for Mianjin, and she's written a beautiful memoir called Eat First, Talk Later, a memoir of food, family and home, which is out now from Penguin Random House. Beth, some enchanted evening from South Pacific. Why was a kid growing up in Kuala Lumpur in the 60s and 70s listening to Rodgers and Hammerstein?
You know, that piece of music still does it for me. I get that little twinge. And really, you know, when I was growing up in Malaysia, we grew up in this really quite nondescript housing estate in a satellite city of Kuala Lumpur. And it was full of ticky-tacky houses that all looked the same, terrace houses. You know, our streets had numbers instead of names. So I grew up on a street called 21/18 in Section 21.
There's a romance to that.
Yeah, well, I didn't think so at the time. But what musicals like South Pacific and The King and I and My Fair Lady did for me, which, you know, these were records that we inherited from my mum's adoptive family when they migrated to the US and other places away from Malaysia, was, you know, we had these records and a really old gramophone player. And so I'd lie on the cool marble floor and look through the records like they were portals to elsewhere. And South Pacific, that fantasy of the tropical island, you know, where romance lives, where magic can happen. It's a dream of beautiful sunsets and love and these incredible voices singing of magical things was just, for me, a doorway into elsewhere.
It's pretty seductive stuff. Later in life, your parents ended up moving to Hawaii. Was this music a kind of reflection of a yearning they had even then to move away, do you think?
I think it was. And I think that's the kind of double bind that you have when you grow up somewhere that is colonized. You know, so when my parents were children, and they were children during the Second World War, so during Japanese occupation, but they had memories of when the British were there and everything was fine and they were safe. So they always had this idea that the colonies were always the periphery and the centre, which was London, England, you know, or somewhere in the West or somewhere in Europe, was somewhere better to be. So we always had that idea that although we lived in this far outpost of empire, that it was better to be somewhere else. And I think for them, because they lived through such a hard time, not having enough to eat, seeing incredible violence, you know, like beheadings, and just the stress and uncertainty of war, they always dreamt of somewhere that they would go where things would be easier. And that dream of a tropical island was very much a part of their dream, which I think I inherited as well. You know, in fact, they wanted to migrate to Hawaii before they had us, you know, before the kids came along. And I blame Elvis for that, Blue Hawaii.
Elvis is responsible for corrupting so many.
Yes, yeah, those hips.
Well, that's right. Who can resist that lure? But part of what made Malaysia such an extraordinary place, particularly at that time, I think, was the great mix of cultures that was there. So your mother was from a Thai background, your father was Chinese. What was it like? Were you very aware of that mix as you were growing up?
Very much so, because we were half and halves, you know, or, you know, half and a quarter, because my mum, we don't exactly know what she is because she was adopted in one of those, you know, market undocumented adoptions. She was given away because she was the youngest daughter, you know, in a family that had too many daughters and didn't value them. You know, we know she's mixed, so she's part Thai, part Eurasian probably, because she had reddish hair. And my dad's Chinese. So we grew up in between races, in between languages, the sounds of many languages. And then our friends around us, you know, Malaysia is a multi-ethnic country. So we had Malay kids around us, real Chinese kids, you know. So we're in Malaysia, you take the race of your father, you know, so I'm considered Chinese, but I'm not a real Chinese. I'm a fake Chinese. I don't speak Chinese. I don't read Chinese. So, you know, there were the real Chinese kids around us as well, and Indian kids. And, you know, within those racial ethnic categories, there were many subgroups as well. So Tamil kids or, you know, Pakistani kids and all the different Chinese dialects as well. So very much we grew up in this polyglot of languages and, you know, a multicultural mix of many, many influences.
The flip side, of course, to that multiculturalism was the kind of tensions that sprang from that. I mean, there were the 1969 race riots, for example.
Yes, yep.
Was that an undercurrent in your childhood?
Very much so. So the 1969 riots, which were couched as racial riots, because we were different races, we, you know, couldn't live together if the immigrant races didn't know their place, violence would break out.
we grew up under the shadow of that, that if you spoke out, if you said something, if you incited racial hatred, you know, if too many of you voted for different party from the ruling party to get in, there would be consequences and they were violent. The odd thing was that this thing overshadowed every part of life. So my whole education, we never really talked about it in, you know, our history lessons. It was too dangerous to talk about, but it was always there in whispers around us, always with the fear of, you know, don't talk about this. Don't make too much noise. Be quiet. Know your place.
That need to be inconspicuous. Part of what I love about your memoir, though, is it manages to tell a story about, on the one hand, you know, those underlying tensions and the need to be inconspicuous, and on the other hand, a kind of sense of freedom and the way in which your childhood was this incredibly free space. Is that a reasonable summation?
I think it is. It's a really insightful summation, because we grew up with this predominant culture of fear, and it kind of carried over from my parents as well, because they saw the consequences of being brutalized, for example, by the Japanese during the war. Certainly my father's side of the family, who were Chinese, you know, not very popular with the Japanese.
That great role that culture and food in particular played in your childhood.
Well, I think when there's a lot of repression, you know, when there's a lot of rules about what you can or can't do or can or can't think, and definitely can or can't say, people get very inventive, you know, about saying the things that they need to. And certainly in terms of the culture of the country and the politics and the history of the country, that definitely happens. But also in the family, you know, I think anybody who's been in any family, you know, like Christmas lunch is the place where it all comes out, all the hidden stuff that you try and be jolly and friendly and keep things nice. But there are all these undercurrents that lie underneath it. And I don't mean that they're all kind of sad or difficult undercurrents. There's also the undercurrents of the tiny stuff that is joyful.
But also, I mean, you set the order of priority right in the title of your memoir. It's Eat First, Talk Later.
It's
celebrate these good, positive sharing moments. And the suggestion is that the food opens a way for that conversation to kind of bubble up. I love your description of the sound the ladles made on cooking pots. That kind of, it's a very evocative memory from your childhood. Tell us about those pots, those prized possessions.
So my mum had three woks. So they are like Chinese woks, but in Malaysia we called them kualis, which is a Malay word that comes from, I think, from India. And so these huge woks, well, she had different sizes, actually, and everything would be cooked in a kuali. So a very strong childhood memory that I have is that combination of the sound, the clack, 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 and the swish, clack. You know, I can't emulate the sound, but I think those of you who've heard it will know, like Chinese restaurants, if you go into the kitchen, you hear that huge, you know, it's a kind of swish, clack sound, and then accompanied by the sizzle. You know, usually the sizzles of onions and garlic and ginger and the smell of it.
Are there particular recipes that take you back to that time and place?
Yes, and different ones for different times. So when I was very little, my Siamese grandmother lived with us for a time before she went to the US, before she migrated with my mum's adoptive family. And she was a fabulous cook, but she cooked everything Thai. And there was this sambal dish. So it's a Thai sambal dish called nam prik pao, which is made out of dried prawns, chilies, huge quantities of chilies, onions, garlic, ginger, shallots. And all of this is chopped up really fine. And, you know, we would help with the chopping. So it's also that sound of the chopper and the chopping board and the grinder. So she had a huge roller grinder in two parts, and you'd roll this big roller, very heavy granite, onto the onions and the garlic and, you know, make a mush, and then that would go into the sizzling oil. So that memory of this dish, you know, and can you imagine the smell that comes out from that? You know, it's
not only can I imagine it, I was going to tell you have to stop because my stomach is absolutely rumbling at the idea of those flavors.
Oh. And it's got coconut sugar in it or cane sugar. And so it's this beautiful combination, you know, so it's combinations of sweet, salty, sour, pungent, spicy. And it's the most beautiful thing. I mean, I miss it. Mm. I can make it because I've got the recipe, but it's never the same. I can't ever make what my grandmother made.
No, No, both literally and figuratively, I imagine. You left Malaysia when you were 20 to study in Australia, and you've lived abroad for many years, including Paris and Sydney. What was it like returning to Malaysia after living overseas? Has KL changed much?
It's changed completely. So I was in Paris for 5 years, and before that I'd go maybe once every 2 years to see my parents who still live there before they migrated to Hawaii. So they're actually now, you know, fulfilling that dream of the tropical paradise that they had. Yeah, I was away for quite a long time, and in the mid-2000s I was deciding whether to leave Paris or not, and I found myself back in Kuala Lumpur and thinking to myself, I know nothing about this country. You know, I thought I did, and in a sense, I had left it to fulfill the dream of becoming a writer, which I did in Sydney. Going back there, you know, I just realized I was wrong about so many things. The culture of fear, for example, that I'd been talking about and writing about for quite some time while I was away. I went back to Malaysia and I found that there were people who were putting their careers and their bodies and their lives on the line in order to stand up for what they believed in. And so I you know, decided I needed to be back in Malaysia and, you know, just try and document it and also see if I could be a part of it. And the only reason that I could do that was because my parents had left.
You could only do that with them gone as a person in your own right rather than a member of a family.
Because they are still so afraid for me to be, you know, in Malaysia saying and doing things that they thought would put me into danger. Was too difficult for them. And it's interesting how, you know, the long arm of that culture of fear, I mean, how long that shadow is, because they've lived in Hawaii for 15 years now. But still, with the publication of my memoir, which actually does talk about an alternative history and alternative politics of Malaysia, and also instances of huge repression and political murder, you know, I do call the Malaysian government authoritarian and corrupt. My parents are still afraid. You know, before this book was published, my dad said to me, okay, you can publish this book, but I want you to take out these words. And the words were authoritarian and corrupt. He said, you can't call the Malaysian government authoritarian and corrupt because you will get into trouble.
And did you?
I don't know. No, not yet.
You didn't take them out, though?
No, because I, you know, I said to my dad, well, if I take those words out, I've got no book.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you, me, mum sitting in a borrowed Land Cruiser trying to relive South Pacific.
That book is called Eat First, Talk Later, a memoir of food, family and home. It's published by Penguin Random House, and it is by today's guest, Beth Yarp. Thanks so much for your time, Beth.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams. You may have caught earlier in the year the first instalment of a new occasional series here on RN called In Season. It's hosted by our very own Professor Tim Entwistle. I'm claiming ownership over you, Tim, and Matthew Crawford. And it looks at the question of seasons in Australia. As Tim himself said, why should we have four seasons? Why must they take up 3 months of the year? Indigenous communities have always known Australia's climate's more complex than a simple four-season arrangement. Very wise words, Tim Entwistle.
I was just thinking. I said those, did I?
Yeah, you're very eloquent.
Well, look, this is the autumn show. So this, in fact, covers April and May. So it's the new Australian autumn. But we also cover the whole country. So we start at the far north of Australia. We work out why in far north Queensland, in fact, you can leave your lawn mower rusting in the shed and why you haven't needed to use it for the wet this year. We go down south where we see lots of fungi popping up around Melbourne and Tasmania and all those kind of places. And we eventually end up looking at the one deciduous plant or the one deciduous native plant in Australia. There's only one species, I'm not going to tell you what it is, Michael, that produces colourful leaves in Australia. You'll have to listen out.
I will definitely be listening out for that. That's Tim and Matthew bringing you the latest instalment of In Season. And that's up next, which means that's it for our show this week. Thanks to producers Maria Tickle and Kathy Pryor, interns Mira Adler Gillies and Buffy Gorilla, and today's technical producer Carrie Dell. Next week, in a constant game of one-upmanship with ourselves, we're taking the extreme travel question a step further to the final frontier, space tourism. In space, no one can hear you ask where the duty-free shop is. Until then, it's goodbye from us, and time for In Season with Tim and Matthew. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN. Have your say on this and other stories at abc.net.au/rn/blueprintforliving. Love it, hate it, tell us. We can take it.
And if I can just pop into your ears for a moment to introduce the latest edition in RN's occasional pop-up series on Australia's seasons, autumn's all around us, and here are your guides.
Okay, you first.
I'm Tim Entwistle.
And I'm Matthew Crawford.
And we're back with In Season.
So it's autumn, but traditional wisdom says we're a bit late. So why are we doing this in April?
Well, I've got my own ideas about seasons in Australia, as you know, at least in the southern parts of the country.
Yeah, this is in your book, right? Sprinter and Sprummer, Australia's Changing Seasons.
Yeah, look, and the change I'm making is for a shorter 2-month season of autumn, coming off the back of this longer 4-month summer. Now, everyone's been talking about the hot March we've just had, a mix of El Nino and climate change. While it's been more summery than usual, I'd argue that we've always had a pretty mild March and it's more useful to start autumn about now. So if you look outside, the leaves are turning, the light's fading, and there's that definite chill in the evening air.
Yeah, well, let's get into this half hour of In Season and some autumnal stories.
Rain-fueled fungus popping up.
Golden leaves, inspiring art.
Breaking through a climate predictability barrier.
And up north, wet seasons without the wet.
Testing, testing, very bloody testing.
Hey, Charlie, do you just want to introduce yourself, say who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name's Charlie McKillop. I'm the rural reporter for Far North Queensland, based in the beautiful city of Cairns.
All right, so we'll get down to the serious business first. Your front lawn, Charlie, how's it looking?
Pretty sad, I have to tell you, Matthew. In fact, my lawnmower could be used as a reliable seasonal indicator because, sadly or happily, depending on your perspective, it's remained dormant in my shed for most of the summer. Not that I'm complaining about that, mind you.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, you don't mind skipping the labour of pushing the thing around, but...
But it just exemplifies the contrast because in a normal season, I mean, if I didn't mow religiously once a fortnight, I'd be, you know, having to cut my way with a machete to the front door. That's how prolific the growth of our lawns in Far North Queensland can be if it's not given the attention that it would normally require.
Well, that's not what I'd expect from the tropical north, Matthew. I've seen these pictures of my aquatic colleagues, and these are the botanists that get down in the water and collect water plants, up to their armpits, literally in these sheets of water that cover the entire landscape. It's a terrible wet time to do fieldwork, usually.
Yeah, right. Well, for the first 3 months of, I guess, a normal year in Cairns, for instance, you might expect up to a metre and a half of rain, just enough to drown one of your aquatic colleagues there. But but with this year's poor wet season, that rain has just not been coming.
It just hasn't. It's been one of those seasons where we really feel like the wet season just never really fired up. The monsoon pattern didn't kick in. You look down the road, I talk about my front lawn looking forlorn, but even places like Innisfail and Tully, about 100 kilometres down the coast, they usually measure their rainfall by the metre, not the millimetre. Now, they've had their driest and second driest February on record, and then you go further inland to towns like Croydon in the Gulf Country, towns of like several hundred residents, and until only a week or two ago faced the very real prospect of running out of water completely. So I guess to the naked eye, if you're driving around Cairns, it's a beautiful tropical city and it looks green and lush, and even just inland on the Atherton Tableland, it gives the appearance of being okay. But people are describing it, farmers in that area, as the green drought.
What's a green drought?
It just means that we've had dribs and drabs of rain, enough to keep things looking lush on the surface, but below the surface, sadly, not enough to fill those dams and those aquifers and give farmers the confidence they need that they're going to have enough water to get through this dry season, which now seems imminent.
And Charlie says she's been hearing from graziers who have been faced with some really tough dilemmas. One of them told her they were going to make the decision to completely destock at Christmas, and that's a devastating thing to have to deal with. But they woke up on Boxing Day to a big fall of rain, and so they got a reprieve. Charlie also talks about other really big properties that get rain on some parts but not others, and it's just been frustrating.
So it's been patchy, but still well below average overall. So what do we know about what's behind these conditions in the north?
What we do have going on at the moment is a large, what we call El Nino in the Pacific Ocean. It is declining, but when we do have El Nino, it's not unusual for us to see poor wet seasons in northern Australia.
And this voice belongs to our climate expert, Robin Duell.
I'm a senior climatologist at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Well, how often does a poor wet season come along in northern Australia?
Well, it varies from year to year, of course. But when we do have an El Nino, it does make it more likely that we'll see a poor wet season. This big break that we've seen just occur is something that we haven't seen for 20 years. So that gives you some idea of how often this sort of thing can happen.
So are we just talking about the far north Queensland, or is this a big break in rain right across the top of Australia?
Well, it's widespread. Even though Darwin had a really wet December, it's been really dry since. Robin says that the barramundi season in the top end started late, so there's an economic impact there. Some tourism ventures in Kakadu National Park have been affected by low water levels. While on the other hand, I guess, over in the Kimberley in WA, there would have been fewer weather-related disruptions to mining operations. So there's probably some winners there too.
So what about tropical cyclones? So in an El Nino season, I think there's less cyclone activity with all that rain, all the rain that can bring. So how's that panning out?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a catch-22 with tropical cyclones because we don't want these huge systems that can cause catastrophic damage on the coast. But when they do hit land and they weaken, they often bring our large rainfall events which bring that recharging to our land with the heavy rains.
Yeah, well, can we look into to the future and taking into account what we know about climate change, what sorts of wet seasons can we expect?
Well, there's a few things that we can say with a bit of certainty about what's going to happen to northern Australia under climate change. For example, we've just experienced a lot of very hot temperatures during this wet season, which has been unusual. We've seen some records break. And so we can expect that into the future that we will see more hot days and warm spells than we have in the past. We can say that with quite high confidence. In terms of changes to rainfall, it's a little bit unclear at the moment how the tropical north will be impacted. It does look like we could see an increased intensity of extreme rainfall events. And in terms of tropical cyclones, it's difficult to make predictions of what will happen to tropical cyclones under climate change because we have quite a small record to look at. But one thing that does look like will happen is that we will see in our region fewer tropical cyclones than we have in the past, but it does look like we'll see more of the ones that do form being stronger in intensity than we currently see.
So warmer temperatures, that's clear, but changes to rainfall, not so clear yet.
Well, it's actually not that dissimilar to the south, really. So more hot days and the problem with storm events, in this case, of course, cyclones, but they're all getting really, really nasty. And what's going to make it tough for the plants, very close to our own heart, of course,
yep.
would be any change to the rainfall patterns. And that seems to be very difficult to predict.
Well, we heard there from Charlie McKillop, the ABC's rural reporter in far north Queensland.
And Robin Duell, who's a senior climatologist at the Bureau of Meteorology.
And we'll have more from Robin soon on RN on this autumn edition of In Season.
Okay, we've got Strathmore Primary here, and I'm with a mycologist. Do you know what a mycologist is? That's one.
I work on fungi like this mushroom, so I'm just on a bit of a hunt here to see what I can find. Have any of you noticed mushrooms around at this time of year?
Yes.
Yeah? What colour have you seen?
Greyish colours.
Yep. Any other colours?
Yeah. Like whitish colours? Like bluish, red and white.
Yes, and look, you can see even here we've got a couple of different sorts of fungi.
So, Matthew, we're at the Melbourne Gardens of Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria for this.
Oh, and these kids are pretty lucky. They've bumped into an actual mycologist and you, the director of the gardens.
Well, look, we all like to hang out in the Fern Gully. It's the coolest place in Melbourne. It's literally.
What's your case?
6 degrees cooler than the CBD. Uh-huh. And look, there's a bit of a breeze blowing as we're recording this, but these kids have got some fascinating questions.
The light can be other different colours.
All different colours. There are red fungi and yellow fungi and green fungi. That's what I really like about them, this huge, beautiful variety of colours.
What happens if you eat it?
Good question.
Well, some fungi are good to eat, like the ones that you get from the greengrocer in the supermarket, but out in the bush you don't know. And some of these fungi are quite poisonous, so you only ever eat mushrooms that you would actually buy from a shop.
All right, so kids getting straight to the point as usual. You always rely on them for a good question. So I gather they need to get on with the rest of their trip in the gardens. So we can hear more from this fungal specialist of yours. And who is he?
Look, it's Tom May. He's a mycologist with the Botanic Garden. So he knows this patch well.
So we got some nice fungus food, some mulch. It's a nice damp gully here. And so these fungi have put up their fruiting bodies. So these are the things that we colloquially call mushrooms. So there's a stalk and a cap. And underneath there's some gills, and that's where the spores of the fungus are produced. And these are just pretty ephemeral. They come up for a couple of weeks, no more. And then the rest of the year, we don't notice any fungi.
So when you don't see these fruiting bodies, the fungi are still here, but we just don't see them at all?
Yeah, most of the time. The growing part of the fungus is these incredibly fine threads that just grow in the soil. And it's only around about autumn when it rains that the fruit bodies appear.
Now, Tom, about 20 years ago, you and I did a report on the conservation status of fungi, algae and other kind of neglected organisms in Australia. And I remember you saying then there are about 250,000, a quarter of a million, probably, fungi in Australia. And we only had described and named about 12,000, which, you know, about 5%. So how are things going 20 years on?
Well, we're probably up to around 15,000 that have been named, but we've got a much better handle about how many more there are. Back then, we thought there were a lot because a lot of fungi associate with plants, and for every plant, there's about 10 different fungi. And now we can actually estimate that much better by looking at the DNA in soil or a plant leaf. So if you just take handfuls of soil, do a DNA fingerprint like they do in the forensic shows, tells us how many different fungi there are. And some recent studies in Australia have pulled out about 25,000 different fungi from about a couple of hundred teaspoons of soil. So that estimate of a quarter of a million, which seemed just enormous, I think actually that's heading to be on the right track.
So these numbers are mind-boggling. Tom can collect just a couple of hundred teaspoons of soil.
Well, look, even in a single teaspoon from one location, you can get hundreds of fungal species.
God, and so in a few handfuls of soil, he can find 25,000 species of fungi.
Oh, look, it's amazing stuff.
I mean, there's about 10,000 species of birds on this whole planet, and yet that's eclipsed by the fungi in this little bit of soil.
I'm afraid so. That's the harsh reality. Birds and animals, apart from insects, are a fairly small part of the world's living diversity. Mm. But look, we've got a lot of work to do. Like Tom was saying, there could be a quarter of a million fungi in this country. We've only sorted out what, say, 15,000 of them are.
Yeah. So today we're on about autumn, right? So what is it about autumn that makes it the season for fungi?
I think the key in Australia is the soil moisture. So it's after summer, the days are getting shorter, a bit cooler, and it's those rains, those damp, misty mornings, and that's when the fungi can start to pop up above the ground. They're rather fragile structures. They can't really tolerate drying out much. So just in that brief window before it gets too cold in winter. But it's very variable, and really any time there's good rain and it's not too hot, you can get mushrooms popping up.
But it is true that you get that peak, is it around April, May, I think, from some of the data I've seen you publish?
Yeah, in southern Australia, that's definitely a big peak. And if we look at when we have records of fungi from FungiMap and when we have herbarium specimens, it's definitely April. And then May is the big peak on average, but every year is different.
Okay, so that's the south of Australia covered. But what about up in the north?
Well, it's flipped around. So it's the wet season that brings out the fungi there, as you'd expect. And Tom tells me access can be really difficult for scientists, so the information's actually quite scarce.
So lots more to learn there as well. But what's that fungi map that Tom's talking about there?
I'm very glad you asked about that. I've been invited to be patron of it.
Oh.
And look, It's a very successful citizen science initiative. Now, the basic idea is if you find an interesting fungus in your neighbourhood, you submit details or a photo, even better, and you'll be contributing to our understanding of the country's fungal landscape. So without this kind of help, our very few mycologists would have an even tougher job on their hands.
Wow, so there's another situation where citizen scientists can make a real difference.
Oh, they're essential, Matthew.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I'll put up a link to that on the RN website. And let me get to a question that In Season asks a lot, I guess. What's the current outlook on how our changing climate might affect this peak fungal season that Tom's talking about?
Well, we've got an interesting situation in Australia over geological time. I think because of the unpredictability of the climate here over a long time, there's a lot of fungi have decided that it's not much good putting up a mushroom, so they've evolved truffles. So we have one of the richest diversity of truffle-like fungi in the world, and that all started happening about 10 million years ago. So already there's been an adaptation to the unpredictability. I think with climate change, the unpredictability is going to be a factor. Also, we seem to be dropping out autumn rainfall. So over the last 10 to 15 years, where the rainfall has got less, it's often dropping out in autumn, and that's exactly the time that the fungi are needing the soil to become moist. But it's difficult without many thousands of records to really pin down a response. But certainly we're trying to gather data to see what might happen.
And Tom says there's a bunch of other things we need to think about as well. If in a changing climate, trees are producing more or less food, fixing more or less carbon, that is, then those changes are going to flow down to the fungi associated with those particular plants. So it's a really complex web, and the consequences of each change are not really going to be obvious.
So, Tim, it seems there's an air of mystery about fungi. You know, we can't see them all the time. We don't necessarily know what roles they're playing. So as a botanist, what do you reckon we need to do about this knowledge gap?
We need to do a lot. Mm-hmm. Nearly every plant depends on a fungus to survive, or many fungi to survive, and they play really important roles in their breaking down leaf litter. They make nutrients available for all kinds of organisms. They help plants which animals like us eat. They're eating themselves. And I bet you didn't know that the Australian truffles form up to 80% of the diet for potoroos, one of our native marsupials.
Well, that's an expensive taste, 80% truffle.
And very special Australian truffles as well. But look, that's another story for another season.
Well, we'll get onto that another time. For now, thanks to Tom May, a senior mycologist at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria.
This is In Season, RN's pop-up series on the seasons.
You can find us online. Just do a search for In Season RN.
I'm tweeting at Tim Entwistle.
And I'm at Matthew on Radio.
Hello, I'm Roseanne Bender. I'm an artist. I'm based in the Huon Valley in Tasmania. Every year on Anzac Day, there's a pilgrimage that goes from Hobart and lots of other people around the valleys to Mount Field National Park to see one of our favourite trees, which is the Nothofagus gunnii. It's the only native deciduous beech tree in Tasmania, and the hills in the alpine region turn golden with this tree during autumn. For me, going into the mountains to capture this particular tree is very exciting for me because of the colour, the vibrancy within the oranges and the reds and the golds within the tree, and sometimes there are aspects of the green still showing within the tree as well. And so this gives me a beautiful colour palette to work with within the artworks that I'm creating. So what I do is photograph up to around 500 photographs in the mountain on any one day. What I get back from the printers, I bring into the studio and I enhance it by drawing into the print with gold and bronze and sometimes silver inks. And so each print that I create becomes unique in that the leaves are never drawn onto the print in exactly the same place. When I look at these completed artworks, I see this glowing gold and amber and the colours of sunset and the colours of fire that will warm my heart and take me through into the colder months of winter as our seasons are changing.
And that was the artist Roseanne Bender talking about Tasmania's only native deciduous tree, Nothofagus gunnii, or deciduous beech.
And she says the species faces some threats from fire and from human intervention. So she wants to see it conserved for future generations. And Tim, where does Nothofagus gunnii fit in with Australia's diversity of deciduous trees?
Well, look, I'm pretty sure it's Australia's only autumnal native deciduous tree.
Only one.
Yeah, we've got some other trees, mostly up in the north, that lose their leaves each year, but not in autumn.
So what's behind that strategy of losing the leaves then?
Well, look, whether it's in the north or the south, it's all about surviving hard times. So for a winter deciduous tree, it's about getting through the cold months when the tree's doing very little growing anyway. Mm. And this is pretty important in the northern hemisphere temperate areas where many of our spectacular autumn-coloured trees come from. And also, of course, our native beech in the cold Tasmania mountains. Mm. But look, up north, it's mostly in the drier months. So that's when the tree is under water stress or about to become under water stress. They drop their leaves to conserve the water and, look, regrow them back when times are better.
Mm. So it's all about making the most of the season that you find yourself
in. And not having your leaves flapping around when things are not so good.
All right. Well, let's move on.
Okay.
Every year, we come across a problem in working out what the coming year of weather is going to be like.
Oh, okay. So what's that called?
Oh, well, it's got a great name. It's called the Autumn Predictability Barrier.
The Autumn Predictability Barrier is something that we talk about in relation to forecasting El Niño or La Niña.
This is Robin Dewell again, the climatologist at the Bureau of Meteorology.
El Niño and La Niña are important to us in Australia because they're one of the biggest drivers of our climate here.
So El Niño is when there's a warmer central Pacific Ocean, which brings drier conditions to Australia.
Yeah, and during La Niña, on the other hand, that's when the Pacific's cooler, and that has the effect of bringing wetter conditions here, especially in the east and the north of the country.
At this time of the year, when we're in autumn and we're trying to look forward to see what happens in winter or spring, that's the time of the year that our models have the most difficulty in forecasting what's going to happen with El Niño or La Niña. Once we get into winter and spring, when events typically start to develop, El Niño and La Niña are autumn-to-autumn phenomena. They usually start to develop in winter and spring, and they peak at the end of the year, and then they start decaying in the first quarter of the next year. So once we start to get into winter and spring, we have a lot more confidence in our outlooks.
And to help get us through this predictability barrier, the Bureau does things like look at international models and also historical data.
So when can the Bureau make this call?
As every month goes past now, we will have more confidence in our forecast. And then
it's not just that it's getting closer, right? It's just that the temperature variations in the ocean, which give you the clues about the weather pattern, they become more obvious as time goes
on. Exactly. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Once you see in the observations early signs of an event starting to form, we get a lot more confidence then. But we're not going to be seeing that yet. That's something that you'll see towards the end of autumn and sometimes not until the winter months.
So what kind of things are on the way, things that will help us break through this autumn predictability barrier and give us more confidence about what's on the horizon?
Well, supercomputers are really important to us when we do climate forecasting.
I love talking about supercomputers. It makes me feel like we're in the 1980s again, but no, but it's a real deal, right? Tell me about your supercomputers.
Yeah, well, so that's how we make our climate predictions at the Bureau, and all other international agencies, they have their supercomputers. It's very important to meteorologists and climatologists. That's how we make our weather forecasts as well. We're really excited at the Bureau because we're having a new supercomputer installed this year, which is 16 times more powerful than our existing supercomputer.
Yeah, wow.
So it means we've got a lot more scope to do more high-precision forecasting of the weather and climate. So, for example, over the next 2 or 3 years, our climate model is going to go from a resolution of 250 kilometres to a resolution of 60 kilometres. And we'll see increases in resolution with our weather forecasting model as well.
Why is that increased resolution really important anyway?
Well, Robin says topography is really important. So if you think about Australia, I suppose large parts of it are flat and smooth. But then there are these sharper features like the Great Dividing Range. And they can have a really big impact on the weather and climate on the areas that surround them.
So if we can get a better resolution over our topography, that's one way how the model will be able to forecast with more precision what's going to happen in the coming weeks and months.
Mm. Exciting times to be a climatologist.
Oh, very. We're very excited.
And it's important stuff because it helps us make the right decisions, right?
Oh, definitely. Right across the community, policymakers and industry too.
Industry, we know, particularly the agricultural industry, rely quite a lot on our climate outlooks. They need to know whether the coming season is going to be warmer than usual or wetter than usual. They may make decisions about what they're going to plant. But there are other climate-sensitive industry as well, construction, retail, which depend on our weather and climate forecasts. Therefore, the better the information we can provide, the better the decisions they can make, which depend on weather and climate.
So, faster supercomputers, more precise forecasts, and better informed decisions. That's where the Bureau of Meteorology wants to take us.
And thanks to Robin Jewell, who's a senior climatologist there.
All right, that's autumn done.
We're back in a couple of months, I guess, in winter.
Yep.
And in the meantime, if you want to look back at this or at our summer edition, just do an internet search for In Season RN.
So all we need to do is thank our favourite friendly fungi, Charlie McKillop's Forest Pretty Mouth.
The elegant blue web cap of Mark Wakeley.
Happy retirement, Mark. Many good seasons ahead for you. And Miyuki Yoki Ranter's splendid red skinhead.
I'm simply Tim Entwistle.
And I'm most complicatedly Matthew Crawford.
Catch you next time on RN's In Season.
See ya.